One of the most ambitious goals in observational cosmology is to try to understand how the universe evolved from its presumed beginnings as a smooth, expanding ball of gas into the familiar collection of stars and galaxies that we observe around us today. In the last decade or two, we've made tremendous progress towards part of that goal, and that's understanding the large role. Pardon me? Off the web. That's understanding the large role that gravitational instability probably played. I'm sure you're all familiar with plots like this, which give you an intuitive feel for how gravitational instability works to slowly draw in more and more material to existing overdensities and make them larger and larger with time. Now, n-body simulations like this one, the code to run them is freely available, the output of them is freely available. They're also reasonably good analytic approximations to understand what's going on. One of the big questions is what to use for initial conditions in these simulations, but here, too, there's been tremendous progress in the last decade. This shows sort of a rough overview of what we think the initial power spectrum looked like, quantized as the RMS mass fluctuation when you smooth the universe on different scales. I've drawn here the theoretical expectation for cold dark matter, but it's more or less broadly consistent with a range of observations over about 3 orders of magnitude in spatial scale, or 10 orders of magnitude in mass. It looks like the power spectrum starts off here more or less like a Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum, and then curves over as it would in a cold dark matter cosmology. But that's only part of the story, of course. It tells us how gravitationally bound structures can evolve, but we really want to know how did galaxies form? How does star formation fit into this picture? And that, as it turns out, has proved far more difficult to model. People are still working on simulations of the formation of even a single star, and we're far away from being able to really model galaxy formation, the formation of 10 to the 10 stars or so of a single galaxy, or galaxies in a realistic volume. As a result, people have had to resort to fairly simplified treatments of galaxy formation. A typical approach is to assume that at any redshift, you'll find one galaxy in each virialized overdensity in the dark matter. In this kind of picture, you'd expect this sort of relationship between galaxies and the underlying mass distribution at different redshifts. It's certainly a very plausible picture for how galaxy formation works, but is it really what happened? Because we can't do it rigorously from first principles, we really need an interplay between observations and theory to try to figure out what went on at high redshift and how galaxies form. No, unfortunately. One thing that is clear, though, is that the history of star formation in the universe is going to be far more complicated than the history of structure formation. This shows a recent estimate of the co-moving star formation density in the universe as a function of time from the beginning to today. It looks like star formation starts out at a pretty good clip soon after the Big Bang, but then for reasons that aren't entirely clear, it begins to die off maybe halfway through the history of the universe, and only a very small fraction of baryons have turned into stars. Of course, structure formation is an ongoing process. Structures can continue to get bigger and bigger, but for some reason, star formation turns off. We'd like to understand why that is. So the title of my talk is Structure Formation and Star Formation at High Redshift, trying to understand how to fit star formation into our understanding of what's going on in the underlying distribution of matter at high redshift. My main collaborators in this are Chuck Steidel at Caltech, Max Bettini at I of A, Mauro Giavalisco, Mark Dickinson at Space Telescope, and Alice Shapley, who's also at Caltech. Here's the overview. In the first two-thirds, I'm going to talk about optically selected galaxies at high redshift, mainly at redshifts 1 and 3. I'll talk about how they can be found and what they teach us about the connection between star formation and structure formation. And then in the final third of the talk, I'll talk a little bit about the role of dust at high redshift. It turns out this is probably the biggest uncertainty in trying to interpret high redshift surveys. Dust has an extremely strong impact on the ultraviolet properties of galaxies, which is, of course, what we see when we look at high redshift galaxies in the optical. Can the extinction by dust be corrected for, and is it so extreme that optically selected galaxies provide only an incomplete view of star formation at high redshift? Those are probably questions that need to be answered before we can really understand what's going on, but it turns out it's difficult to answer them at present. There's good reason to suspect that optical surveys might provide a rather poor view of star formation at high redshift. This plot shows the typical spectral energy distributions of star-forming galaxies in the local universe. You can see that, and optical range is here, and this is the far infrared out here. You can see that as objects form stars more rapidly, as their bolometric luminosities go up, an ever larger fraction of it emerges out here in the far infrared. When we work in the optical, all we're seeing is this section about there that I've colored in yellow. You can imagine that by only observing here, you might have no idea what's going on here. You could also imagine that a galaxy with a huge star formation rate with a huge amount of dust out in the far infrared might be missing from surveys that can only pick out galaxies here. It turns out this is it's sort of trivial in conceptually whether you're better off observing galaxies here or here when you work at high redshifts, but it has really large practical consequences. To try to illustrate that, I'll show you a view of the same part of the sky at two different wavelengths. This is what the Hubble Deep Field looks like in the optical, of course. There are thousands of sources. There's a lot of information. You have colors and morphologies and so on. And of course, with a modern ground-based telescope, you can cover an area that's about 100 times bigger than this in one shot. In contrast, this is a state-of-the-art image at 850 microns in the submillimeter, which is where you detect dust emission. So you can see the information content is far lower. This is the same area of the sky, but you can only detect about five sources. And the field of view is also much smaller than you can get from the ground in the optical. And so if it really is true that most of the star formation at high redshift is enshrouded in dust, we're going to have to find high redshift galaxies with data like this. That's going to set us back probably decades in our understanding of the high redshift universe. So in the second part of my talk, I'll talk about this and try to answer the question, do we really need to rely on data that looks like this to understand the high redshift universe? Okay, so that's some of the motivation for finding high redshift galaxies, but how do you do it in practice? How do you find the large numbers you need to do these kinds of tests? This shows an optical image of part of the sky. A typical approach to finding high redshift galaxies in the past was a magnitude-limited redshift survey, where you start out with the brightest object and get a redshift and slowly work your way down to fainter and fainter objects and hope that before you ran out of telescope time, you'd have a large number of galaxies at high enough redshift. It turns out in practice, though, this doesn't work all that well. Even in the deepest surveys, the vast majority of galaxies you find in a magnitude-limited survey lie at redshifts less than one, where it looks like not all that much star formation happened. If you really want to see the action, you have to go to higher redshifts, and magnitude-limited surveys don't work for that. The approach we've taken instead, rather than obtaining spectra of all these objects, is just going after the ones I've circled here. These are ones that we expected ahead of time would be at high redshift. The ones circled in red we expected would be at redshift 3. The ones in blue we expected would be at redshift 1, and we only obtain spectra for those. In a fair part of the sky, there'd be four times more, but I wanted to give people something to look at. At four times more at redshift 1, yeah. So how did we know ahead of time that the objects we've circled might be at high redshift? It was because we had photometry in several bands, and galaxies at different redshifts have distinctive colors. This plot in the yellow here shows a typical spectrum of a star-forming galaxy that's been placed at redshift 1. It's a model galaxy. And I've drawn on top of it the filter band passes of the GR and I band. You can see that if a galaxy lies at redshift 1, the Balmer break will fall between the R and the I bands. And so you could detect it in your image by looking for an object that's much brighter in I than in G or R. Similarly, galaxies at redshift 3 have a strong break at 9-12 angstroms rest from the Lyman limit, which arises partly due to intrinsic absorption in the atmospheres of massive stars. But as those photons leave the stars, they go through the ISM. That makes the break at 9-12 angstroms stronger yet. And finally, as the photons leave the galaxy, they hit the thick intergalactic medium at high redshift, and that makes the break even stronger still. So you can find galaxies at redshift 3 by looking for objects that aren't there in the U filter, but are there in the G and R filters. These are pretty simple techniques, but it turns out you can do surprisingly well with them. This plot shows a redshift histogram of galaxies we've selected with those techniques and similar techniques. These are Balmer break galaxies at redshift 1. These are Lyman break galaxies at redshift 4 and 3. These are selected with a different technique at redshift 2. You can see it's not perfect. In some cases, we get some interlopers there and there. But overall, you can do reasonably well. You really can pick out the high redshift galaxies with color pre. Those are miscellaneous criteria, exploratory things. That didn't turn out all that well. Yeah, there were different criteria we saw, tried to test if that would work. So So once you have large numbers of star-forming galaxies at high redshift, how can you try to make connections between these galaxies and what's going on in the underlying distribution of matter? Well, the first thing that might occur to you is that you can paint a spectra like this. This shows the O3 and H beta for galaxy at redshift 3. By measuring the velocity width, you might hope that you could somehow constrain the circular velocities of the galaxies, of the dark matter halos that are hosting these galaxies. It's not clear to me, though, that this is going to end up being very, very successful. Part of the problem is that, of course, baryons are dissipative, so they've collapsed farther down than the dark matter, and the velocity you get just from looking at the stars is expected to be significantly smaller than the circular velocity. The exact relationship between the stellar velocity dispersion and the circular velocity dispersion is a little bit complicated. It's not clear ahead of time exactly what it will be. We tend to find rather low velocity dispersions for Lyman Break galaxies at redshift 3, about 70 or 80 kilometers per second, and that's significantly smaller than their expected circular velocities. But it's hard to know if this is telling us anything other than that the baryons have dissipated and collapsed down on the rising part of the rotation curve. An alternate approach, which I think has worked better so far and may continue to work better for a long time, is to measure the spatial distribution of high redshift galaxies and then compare it to what you think is going on in the underlying distribution of matter at high redshift. So we can pick out galaxies at this redshift and this redshift. We can see how the galaxies cluster, and we can ask, well, what kind of objects in the underlying distribution of matter share this same spatial distribution? This plot shows the redshift distributions of Lyman Break galaxies in six different fields. Each of the bins in this plot has a co-moving size for a lambda cosmology of about 11 by 11 by 25 megaparsecs. The green bars show the number of galaxies we measured at each redshift, and the plot in yellow in the background shows our overall selection function. At first glance, these redshift histograms don't look all that different from those you might have seen in the local universe. You see galaxies tending to lie in a few spikes, maybe with voids in between them. But it turns out these are actually different in a very significant way from redshift histograms in the local universe. Yeah, I don't think there's good evidence for that. It turns out if you stick these two plots together, then this one and that one have the 128 megaparsec, and Tom Broadhurst picked up on that. But you don't see it anywhere else. These galaxies all meet our criterion. We only have spectroscopy for about half of them in each field because of limits in telescope time.
And the selection function, can you describe a little bit more? That's presuming some underlying spectrum.
Well, it's... in practice, what we do is we have data like this for about 12 fields, so we coarsely bin together and just fit a spline to it. The reason it rises up in the middle and dies down is because galaxies meet the Lyman break criterion the best right as the break's passing between filters, but they can still meet it at slightly different redshifts. About 3/4. It depends a lot on the weather, but on a good night, 3/4. We haven't done that enough to say for sure. Sometimes we'll succeed on things we failed on, sometimes we don't. I haven't quantified that enough to know if it tells us those things really at the wrong redshift. Now, the interesting thing about these plots is that these bin sizes are so huge. If you were to smooth the local universe with a filter of this spatial size, you wouldn't see all that large of mass fluctuations from one bin to the next. And of course, as you move to high redshift, you'd expect the mass fluctuations to be significantly smaller. To give you some idea of about how large you'd expect the mass fluctuations to be from bin to bin, I made this plot. The purple line in the background, again, shows the overall shape of our selection function, and the green bar shows about the size of the max fluctuations you'd get from one bin to the next. So you can see if we lived in a flat cosmology, you'd expect very similar amounts of mass in one bin to the next. If galaxies were unbiased tracers of mass, our redshift histograms would be Poisson realizations of histograms like the green one here. They'd hew very tightly to the average overall. For an open or lambda cosmology, you get bigger mass fluctuations from one bin to the next. But still, you don't get anything nearly as large as the galaxy fluctuations we see. And to illustrate that, I've drawn on the side here the size of a typical galaxy over density in one of the fields we've seen. You can see it's completely off scale. It's far larger than anything you'd expect to see in mass fluctuations. Okay, it's our, but it's still true. So this, so it's interesting. It looks like the galaxy fluctuations are far bigger than anything you'd expect to see in the mass. Another way of quantifying this is to get the correlation function of the galaxies at redshift 3. The projected correlation function looks something like this. It's consistent with a correlation length of about 4 megaparsecs and a slope of minus 1.6. So in other words, it's very similar to the correlation function of galaxies in the local universe, even though you're looking back at high redshift when mass fluctuations are so much smaller. So what does this tell you? Well, you might refer back to an n-body simulation and ask yourself, well, what kind of objects in an n-body simulation would have the kind of clustering as these galaxies we've seen? The first guess you might have is, well, maybe the probability you form a galaxy at any place is just proportional to the mass density. That's what people thought for a long time. But if that were true, then galaxies would cluster like the mass at redshift 3, and they'd be significantly weakly clustered than we see. But that's kind of a naive view. Maybe you'd think instead, well, galaxies actually will form wherever there's a collapsed overdensity, a virialized object with overdensity of about 200 or so. These things shown in yellow there. But it turns out these galaxies are much more strongly clustered even than typical collapsed objects at high redshift. There is, however, one population of objects in this image that clusters like Lyman Break galaxies, and it's the ones that are circled in blue here. And these are the most massive collapsed objects at high redshift. So it looks like the galaxies we can see, the ones that are brightest in the ultraviolet, share the same clustering properties as the most massive collapsed objects at high redshift. The mass depends a lot on cosmology. It's sort of 10 to the 12 for realistic cosmology, but 10 to the 10 for Einstein de Sitter. Now, the interesting thing about this is that it implies there's a simple relationship between mass and star formation rate in high redshift galaxies, because we pick out galaxies based on their star formation rate, which is what ultraviolet observations select on, and it seems like their clustering properties, it's as if we'd pick them out based on mass. A simplified way to look at this you can get from this view graph. The bottom panel shows the approximate mass distribution you'd expect in Preschecter for collapsed objects at high redshift. The vast majority of them have relatively low masses. Now, it turns out that if you look at analytic approximations or n-body simulations, you find that as the mass of objects decreases, they tend to get more numerous, and at the same time, you observe that they're more weakly clustered. So the vast majority of objects here have very weak clustering strengths. They don't cluster at all like the galaxies we observe. It turns out the Lyman Break galaxies cluster as if they were drawn only from this very tip of the mass function. Now, there's some slop a little bit. It doesn't have to be exactly a sharp line there, but nevertheless, it seems as if most of the brightest Lyman Break galaxies, based on their clustering strength, are drawn from the massive end of the mass function. If this were really true, if Lyman Break galaxies really were mainly coming from this part, you might expect a simple relationship between the shape of the mass function there and the luminosity function of Lyman Break galaxies. I'm not sure how much I believe this, but this shows our observed luminosity function in the ultraviolet of these galaxies and the dust-corrected luminosity function. Since this is R magnitude, it's sampling UV magnitude in the rest frame, so it's a measure of star formation rate. So this is our best guess of the star formation rate distribution of Lyman Break galaxies at redshift 3. I've also drawn at these two ends the shape of the luminosity function you would expect if star formation rate were proportional to mass at the bright end and mass to the 1.5 at the faint end. It turns out those exponents are more or less what you'd get in simple semi-analytic models, where in the bright end it's more or less proportional to in the faint end, it's modified by supernova feedback. So it's at least...
How low is the absolute normalization? How low do you get the 0 points in
the break? That's hard, actually. The problem is that these star formation rates that corresponds to naively seem much higher than the cooling rates you'd expect. So if it really were just cooling, which is what I'm assumed with this slope here, you wouldn't get as high a star formation rate. But on the other hand, all we see is the mass event. We don't know the shape of the IMF. Our dust corrections could be wrong, so I'm not sure how important that is, but the normalization wouldn't be right. So I think overall the observations at redshift 3 are at least broadly consistent with this notion that galaxies are forming in dark matter halos and that mass of the hosting halo has a large influence on the star formation rate. This again was based mainly on their clustering properties, but you could imagine there's other ways to get strong clustering properties other than this one picture of galaxy formation. For example, if you were to pull these blue circles, which represent the galaxies, with respect to the underlying mass distribution, you'd still have exactly the same observed galaxy properties, but there'd be a totally different relationship between galaxies and mass. And the really fundamental prediction of this scenario for galaxy formation isn't that galaxies are strongly clustered, but it's that the galaxies are forming where there's a lot of mass already. Well, so how can we test if that's really what's going on? One way is to obtain galaxy redshifts in a place where you also have quasar spectrum. And the idea is illustrated by this view graph showing the output of an n-body simulation. You can imagine observing a quasar through it, measuring the Lyman alpha absorption at each point. Now, people have found in simulations that the Lyman alpha absorption, it gives you a reasonably good measure of the mass at each redshift. And so this, by observing the Lyman alpha forest absorption, you have some idea of what the mass is doing along a sight line. You can try to see, are the galaxy overdensities really lining up with the mass overdensities? To do this, you'd want to use the fluctuating Gunn-Peterson approximation, which is illustrated by this view graph. You start out with a quasar spectrum. I've drawn a tiny section of one here, showing the flux you get divided by the continuum flux at different wavelengths. Of course, flux is just related to tau in this way, so you can turn this into a map of optical depth tau. You don't know exactly what's going on here where the spectrum's saturated, but you can get a map overall. And then simulations tell you that there's a simple relationship between tau and the relative overdensity of the matter at each point. So you can turn this map of tau into a map of the matter overdensity. So you can imagine looking along a quasar sight line, binning up the galaxies in each of the cubes, and then binning up the expected mass you get in each cube, and looking, is there a correlation between the amount of matter and amount of galaxies? This is still very preliminary. We'll end up doing it better, but this shows one of the first results from this. This line in the background shows what we would get for the mass distribution at different redshifts in one field using the fluctuating Gunn-Peterson approximation. I've binned this up in different bins, and that produces the average density shown in the red dots for the mass. At each redshift, I've also shown the galaxy overdensity we get. You can see that the correspondence isn't perfect, but nevertheless, when the mass overdensity tends to lie above the line, so too do the galaxy overdensities. For the most part, there are some exceptions. Another way to look at this plot is to plot up the galaxy overdensity we see at different mass overdensities. So for each of the bins, I've drawn in blue a point where at the galaxy mass overdensity as a function of mass overdensity. And the points in red show the average in different bins. So you can see that overall, even though it's an extremely simple thing, it looks like we are seeing that typically you get underdensities in galaxies and their underdensities in mass. Decreases more or less goes through zero. So I think this is encouraging. We'll end up doing it a lot better, but there's broad consistency at least with what we would have expected. The only information we really have about these galaxies at redshift 3 are their spatial positions and their star formation rates. That's why I've been talking about those things. But of course, there's a lot more you might want to know about galaxies. You'd like to know their circular velocities. You'd like to know the size of their older stellar populations and so on. You want a lot more information than you can get at redshift 3 to really rigorously test models of galaxy formation. Turns out if you want to do this, you're probably better off moving down to redshift 1. At redshift 1, everything's brighter, of course, because it's closer to you. And at the same time, you're bringing everything more into the optical window, away from the infrared window where the sky background's high. So you can measure the size of older stellar populations. You can see far enough into the red before the atmosphere gets bad. And also, lines that give you velocity dispersions are drawn into the optical window rather than the infrared, and so it's much easier to learn that as well. So I started up a project to find galaxies at redshift 1. I like to illustrate it, the technique with this plot, which shows the Balmer breaks I discussed earlier, but it's actually, our selection criterion is a little more complicated than this plot suggests. I'll try to explain it with this plot, which shows the expected colors. I think it'll make sense. I think it will. It shows the expected colors in the GRI plane of different objects you might expect to get in a deep image. These are stars here. These tracks show the expected colors of galaxies at different redshifts as a function of redshift, starting at 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, and so on, circling around. And I've drawn the dots large at redshifts 0.9, 1, and 1.0. The different tracks at each color correspond to different amounts of dust in these galaxies, which tends to redden things, moving this way. And the different color tracks correspond to different galaxy types or star formation histories. These galaxies have older stellar populations than these. Our selection criterion is to pick everything that's on this side of the red line. You can see most of these large dots at redshift 0.9 to 1.1 lie on this side of the line. And the reason is that as you age a population or add dust, you tend to move things more or less parallel to our selection criterion, so it still does a reasonably good job of getting everything. Now, it's really only Balmer break selection for galaxies down in this corner. By the time you have this kind of galaxy, it's more 4,000 angstrom break selection, but nevertheless, it'll match our criteria. Yeah. Yeah, the ellipticals are, you can see a low redshift point here, they're completely off. But we're after star-forming galaxies, we're not after older ones. So if you get actual data, it matches these simple expectations reasonably well. This shows, again, the same two-color diagram, but I've color-coded the redshifts measured for objects at different locations here. So you can see that these are all mainly low redshift galaxies out here. You start to get objects around redshift 0.8 or so, increasing to 1, redshift about 1, and then the exit here, redshift's 1.4 or so. So it looks like just getting objects to this side of that line, you do a reasonably good job of getting galaxies at redshift 1. The overall redshift distribution of galaxies matching that criterion we've observed so far looks like this. We have about 700 galaxies, mean redshift of 1.0, and a sigma of 0.1. So what fraction of galaxies at redshift 1 actually meet this criterion? I've tried to address that with a plot like this. These are data where we had our three-color images, but there are also existing magnitude-limited redshift surveys. The bars in yellow show the number of galaxies at each redshift in the magnitude-limited survey, and I color-coded them blue if they happen to match our Balmer-Break selection criterion. So you can see it looks like maybe somewhere between two-thirds and a half or so of the known galaxies at redshift 1 will match this criterion. It's not perfect, but it does give you a reasonably good view of star formation at redshift 1. I think we'll end up learning a lot from this. Most of the analysis hasn't been done yet, but one of the first things to come out of it that's interesting is that yeah, so no, you can see it. I'm not showing it to you because it's selected in a difficult way. This is Mark Dickinson was trying to find a cluster of elliptical galaxies at high redshift based on weird criterion. And it's not as representative as the other. Sorry, did I? What was your question? Oh, yeah. I think the majority of them are basically consistent with photometric errors. They're close enough to the criterion that if you had perfect photometry, they'd be in it. There's some that are just early types that were missing, but I think most were scattered. So an interesting thing we've learned is that these galaxies at redshift 1 turn out to be relatively weakly clustered. This shows redshift histograms in different fields. Each bin here is about 6 megaparsecs by 6 by 25 megaparsecs. It turns out that the fluctuations about our mean selection function in each bin are roughly the same size as they were at redshift 3. But of course, at redshift 3, we had a much bigger bin. It was about, let me see, does that work? At redshift 3, it was about 11 by 11 by 25. At redshift 1, it's about 6 by 6 by 25. And we're still getting the same size of fluctuations. And of course, mass fluctuations are much bigger at redshift 1 than redshift 3. So the implication seems to be that the galaxies we picked out at redshift 3, the Lyman break galaxies we see at redshift 3, aren't the same ones as we're seeing at redshift 1, because of course clustering strength only grows with time, but the Balmer break galaxies we see at redshift 1 are less strongly clustered than Lyman break galaxies at redshift 3. Okay, so So if you look at, it turns out that the variance about the mean selection function is roughly the same at redshift 1 and redshift 3 in these bins. But at redshift 3, the bins are much bigger. They're about 12 by 12 by 25. Redshift 1, they're about 6 by 6 by 25. So it means in co-moving units, they're more weakly clustered. And the clustering strength of form galaxies should only increase with time. And it turns out this clustering strength we see for galaxies at redshift 1 is inconsistent with there being line and break galaxy descendants. Yeah, it does, because as you go fainter, it looks like line and break galaxies are more weakly clustered. But the effect is not strong enough to account for it. So in other words, if you select at the same abundance, line and break galaxies are more weakly clustered. Bomb and break galaxies are more weakly clustered than line and break descendants. This is interesting because our selection of bomb and break galaxies at redshift 1 gives us a reasonably complete view of star formation in objects with about more than one solar mass, say, per year of star formation. These plots show our luminosity functions uncorrected for dust at redshift 1 and redshift 3. This actually extends significantly fainter, but we begin to get incomplete. But nevertheless, down to about one solar mass per year of star formation, it looks like we're getting the majority of the objects at redshift 1. So this seems to suggest that Lyman break galaxy descendants aren't even forming stars at one solar mass a year at redshift 1. Maybe.
In a high redshift, I presume your UV is very sensitive from the stellar component to the amount of metal. So how does it get, maybe you can help describe a little more, how do you get the X-axis from the solar mass sphere? What's the conversion you use?
We're using the conversion of Madow, Pezzetti, and Dickinson.
That's meaning to me. So what's the...
I forget the numerical value. Yeah.
So this is emissions presumably from what?
From massive stars.
From the massive stars.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm asking about the metal effect, because the line collecting is strong.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what's the correction? So you get a certain flux, you actually want to get, as you say, the x-axis. But I'm wondering, there's got to be an effect through metal.
Yeah. But the thing is... Yeah, we don't know the metallicity well enough to...
Can I just shift? How do you know you can't shift these?
I don't think you could shift them enough to take care of the problem. I mean, you'd have to shift them by a factor of 5 or something to have. But these are roughly the same rest wavelength. So this is U band at redshift 1 and R band at redshift 3. So it's nearly the same rest wavelength. Yeah, the dust. Yeah.
You're still depending on knowing something about the UV emissions from massive stars.
Yeah. I don't think it's a tremendously strong effect. I mean, I think it's sort of 50% effect or something. I don't think it's going to shoot down a conclusion.
But I don't see how. It's not clear to me that it's a factor 2. It could be a factor 1. There's almost no emission in UV.
Well, 1800. Yeah, but we should talk about this afterwards.
That worries me a lot. Everything we did that was done with UV showed they were all brighter than UV than all the Toulouse models or anybody's models in terms of observation. So those are for local stars. So, for solar abundance, it's not well understood. It worries me even more.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's a good point. We should talk about that after the talk. But probably the biggest uncertainty in all this is the role of dust extinction. Dust is known to strongly attenuate the UV selected property, the UV properties of galaxies, and all these things are selected based upon their UV fluxes. Probably the best indication we have that these galaxies are dusty comes from this Lyman alpha equivalent width distribution for Lyman break galaxies at redshift 3. It turns out that the mean equivalent width we observe is basically exactly equal to zero. And how can that be? Well, of course, there's some fraction of the luminosity emitted by massive stars comes out shorter than 912 angstroms. Where does that energy go? We can see that it's not leaking out of the galaxies. So presumably it's going into ionizing hydrogen and should ultimately come out in Lyman alpha. whether you see Lyman alpha in emission or absorption for any one galaxy could depend on the vagaries of geometry. But when you have hundreds of galaxies like this, you'd expect you should see a positive emission feature in Lyman alpha. And we don't. So what happened to that energy that came off these stars shorter than 9-12 angstroms that presumably went into ionizing hydrogen? Where is the energy coming out? I think the best guess is that as it was resonantly scattered in Lyman alpha, it was absorbed by dust, and it's actually coming out in the far infrared rather than the Lyman alpha line. Of course, it doesn't take a whole lot of dust to quench Lyman alpha like that, but the indications we have are that these galaxies actually are pretty dusty. This plot illustrates that. It shows the measured G minus R colors of our galaxies. That's roughly the slope in the ultraviolet of galaxies in our sample at different redshifts, shown by the boxes and X's here. And these tracks show the expected colors you would get for different dust reddenings for an assumed underlying spectrum. The tracks get redder with redshift because the Lyman alpha force is beginning to cut into the G band and artificially reddening the colors. But nevertheless, we see very few galaxies as blue as you would get if there's no extinction at all. Most things are maybe half a magnitude or a magnitude redder than you'd expect for the no extinction case. And that would correspond to probably about 3 magnitudes, somewhere between 0 and 3 magnitudes of extinction in the ultraviolet. What we estimate based on these colors for the overall distribution of extinctions at 1600 magnitudes is this, as shown in this plot. Just pay attention to the green bars, which show our overall best guess at the extinction histogram. Points with negative extinctions have colors that are contaminated by Lyman alpha emission, so you can ignore those. This is now based on Moirer's empirical relationship between ultraviolet slope and ratio of ultraviolet to far infrared luminosity. Yeah, they're for nearby starbursts. So anyway, this is what we estimate for overall histogram. When you see this, it should make you a little bit nervous because it means that the typical correction we're applying for dust extinction of these galaxies is maybe a factor of 5 to 10 or so. And in some cases, we're applying as much as a factor of 100 correction for dust extinction. So we believe we're just seeing a tiny trace amount of the energy emitted by massive stars in the ultraviolet. We're applying very large corrections to try to get at the star formation rate. Are those corrections justified? It's something that I think you need to worry about. Also, a related point is that, of course, even though by number these less extincted galaxies dominate, galaxies here tend to have, when you correct them, they tend to have larger fluxes. And the slope, it turns out, for here converges. If you'd estimate the amount of star formation rate for galaxies in each of these bins, it would be dominated by galaxies about here. But if we were slightly wrong about the slope of the histogram, you might imagine that actually most of the star formation rate could be happening out here. The distribution wouldn't converge at the limits we've observed to. We think it does, but how well do we really know the slope here? And even if we have that right, how do we know there's not some other hump out here that we're completely missing where most of the star formation occurs at high redshift? A number of people have suggested that that's the case, that most of the star formation is occurring in objects somewhere off the plot here. Well, is that true? Turns out that it's very difficult to answer that with the data we have available. The typical way you estimate star formation rates for galaxies is to look at to try to figure out the number of massive stars they have. Massive stars are short-lived, of course, so the fact that they exist tells you star formation must have happened recently. And by assuming a steady state, you can work out, by dividing the number you observe by the typical lifetimes, you can work out a star formation rate. That's the approach that's usually taken at high redshift. The way you work out the number of massive stars you have is by trying to figure out the total energy they emit. But it turns out that's quite difficult because the energy emitted by massive stars emerges over a very large range of wavelengths in these galaxies. This plot shows the cartoon spectra of starbursts in the local universe. As you add more, the energy is initially released by massive stars. It comes off their atmospheres, mainly in the ultraviolet, but it can be absorbed by dust. The fraction that's absorbed by dust will typically emerges at about 100 microns in local galaxies. There's also a trace amount of energy that comes out in the radio wavelength presumably from electrons and supernova remnants. So to work out the amount of massive stars you have, you really need to add up the total amount of energy coming out over all this range. But that's rarely observed in high redshift galaxies. If most of the energy came out here in the ultraviolet, that would be redshifted I've drawn on this axis the location of various atmospheric windows. So if most of the energy were coming out here in the ultraviolet, it would be redshifted into the optical window here. We could pick it up. It wouldn't really matter what was going on out here if the ultraviolet luminosity dominated. But in fact, when we look at star-forming galaxies in the local universe, it turns out that most of their energy is coming out here in the far infrared, not in the ultraviolet. So to get star formation rates, you really need to figure out the total flux here. But that's difficult because there just aren't any atmospheric windows there at all. All this flux is being blocked by the atmosphere, but somehow you have to estimate it to figure out a star formation rate. Even though it's difficult to know how to estimate a star formation rate from the typical observations you have in any one of these atmospheric windows, one thing that is pretty clear is that the 850 micron background probably provides you with a reasonably good measure of the total amount of star formation that has happened at high redshifts. So you can see that with this plot, where I've drawn the same cartoon spectrum of a galaxy at different redshifts, where it's dimmed due to the greater distance, but it's also redshifted. You can see that at 850 microns, a galaxy, because these two effects cancel each other out, the galaxy has more or less the same flux, no matter what its redshift is. So the brightness of the 850 micron background really tells you about the total amount of star formation that's happened at high redshift for this reason. What we'd like to know is, do the UV-selected populations that we know about, do the ones we see, would they produce, do they have enough star formation in them to account for the entire 850 micron background that we observe? How can we tell that? Well, it turns out that there's, in local galaxies, you observe a relationship between the slope of continua in the ultraviolet and the ratio of far infrared to ultraviolet flux. So when things have very little dust, they tend to have spectral shape like this. When the ratio of dust emission to the unattenuated emission is small, galaxies tend to have a slope like this. As you add more dust, it tends to get steeper and steeper. So by using both the slope here and the height, you can predict the total amount of flux that's coming out in the far infrared. It turns out for local galaxies, where you can actually measure this from satellites, you can get the total amount of flux coming out here to about a factor of two or so using this correlation and UV observations only. So this provides us some way that we can, based on the UV data we have, we can estimate the total contribution of the 850 micron background from high redshift galaxies. Yeah. I mean, it's a really tough game. So that was based on local data. Well, does it work at high redshift? Can you use these correlations to predict the far infrared and radio properties of high redshift galaxies? This is a submillimeter selected source. We obtained UV photometry for it last fall. Based on that, we estimated the slope and then predicted what the far infrared and radio fluxes would be if these objects obeyed the correlations that local galaxies have. The prediction is that the measured point should fall somewhere in these yellow shaded regions. Actual measure values are shown here as the blue dots. So at least in this one case, it looks like you could have done a pretty good job of predicting the 850 micron properties of this galaxy from the ultraviolet.
The UV slope, is that depends from the IMF? Is that?
It doesn't depend. I mean, this... No, for two reasons. I mean, in the first place, it doesn't depend all that strongly on the IMF. Anyway, but in the second place, we're just measuring what we observe it to be. We don't assume any IMF at all. It's just an observed quantity. Yeah. Yeah. So we're assuming the empirical relationship at high ratios. Yeah. Okay, so here's one galaxy where you could have predicted its 850 micron flux. But does that work for other galaxies? Well, Scott Chapman and company looked for 850 micron flux for a number of Lyman break galaxies. They looked at about 11. Only one of them had a significant detection. The uncertainties, for reasons I don't have time to go into, are very large, especially on the predicted flux shown on this axis, but also on the observed flux. If it turns out if you do a formal fit, the 90% credible interval on the slope of the line is something like this. So predicted equals observed falls in there. Doesn't look all that good. We have one galaxy here that we detected significantly brighter than we thought, and it's not even the one we expected to be the brightest. But again, the uncertainties are large, and when you run simulations, you can convince yourself that most of the galaxies should fall below this line, predicted equals observed, and the smaller fraction should fall above it. So it's not as bad as it looks, but it is maybe bad. Another way to test it is by looking at the radio fluxes of galaxies. In this case, these are galaxies for our Redshift 1 sample. Radio fluxes are known to be correlated with far-infrared fluxes, so we can predict from the ultraviolet properties of far-infrared flux, and from that, a radio flux. That there's, of course, a lot of scatter when you do that. This shows the approximate error bar in the predicted radio flux, and these are the different points for our Redshift 1 sample. But there is at least a clear correlation of higher observed flux for different predicted fluxes. This is shown by the dashed crosses here, which showed the measured fluxes for galaxies in different bins of predicted flux. So the uncertainties are big. It doesn't exactly agree with our expectations, but it's maybe not completely inconsistent either. Yeah. So if you do something like Kendall's tau, the formal significance of a positive correlation is 99%. But the consistency with the line predict equals observe is harder to estimate because it depends on our selection criteria and photometric errors and things like that. And we haven't done it. But I mean, based on binning it, I would guess that it seems like we're significantly low at the high ends. So finally, this is the last bit of evidence that's available. Well, it was established locally for UV-selected starbursts, where they later looked up infrared fluxes for them. Yeah. Okay, finally, I'll show you the last bit of evidence we have that you can predict the dust properties of galaxies from their UV properties. This shows the 15-micron fluxes, which samples part of the dust emission for galaxies in our Redshift 1 sample, again, predicted versus observed. The data were drawn from a catalog that was published with a 3-sigma limit, so all we know in many cases is that the objects weren't in the catalog. Those are drawn by downward-pointed green arrows. In the cases where the object was in the catalog, it's drawn by a blue cross. So you can see the large number of undetected objects when we expected them to be faint. And then at the bright end, where we expect things to be detectable, we start getting a large fraction of detections. That's actually pretty statistically significant to have so many non-detections here and a number of detections there. At any rate, I don't think the data is completely convincing on this point. I'll say more about this later. But let's assume it is true. Let's assume that galaxies at high redshift obey these local correlations and that you can figure out the 850-micron fluxes from UV properties. In that case, this plot shows the total contribution to the 850-micron background you would get from known UV-selected populations at redshift 1 to 5. So our best guess is shown here by this yellow, by the yellow shaded curve. It turns out that the overall area here agrees remarkably well to the observations. It agrees to about 10%, but of course that's only a coincidence because the systematic uncertainties in this are quite large. These dashed lines take into account only part of the systematic uncertainty. But nevertheless, the observed 850-micron background isn't any higher, really, than you would have expected UV-selected populations to produce. These points here show the measured background in different bins. This is also shown here as the cumulative number counts. This is our best guess for UV-selected populations at high redshift, and this is what's observed. So at the bright end, it looks like it's not getting it right, but that's not surprising because there's AGN contribution at the bright end. But maybe it's consistent overall with the idea that the bulk of 850-micron background is coming from high redshift galaxies, from UV-selected high redshift galaxies. I'll briefly show this plot, which shows what you would expect if UV-selected galaxies were producing most 850-micron background. This shows what you would expect for their apparent magnitudes at different flux levels. So this is greater than 24, this is between 24 and 25.5, and so on. So you'd see even at relatively bright 850-micron fluxes, you'd expect these galaxies to be quite faint. There was a time when people were saying that most of the background brighter than 3 millijanskis is coming from things fainter than 24, and that this proved that they couldn't be UV-selected galaxies. But it's actually more complicated than that, because UV-selected galaxies themselves are quite faint. And so it's not entirely clear to me that objects are actually coming in any fainter than you expect if they were drawn to selected populations. Okay, so let me just quickly summarize the evidence. Is most of the high redshift star formation hidden from UV-selected surveys? I'll present arguments both ways. The argument that no. Okay, well, first of all, the shape and the amplitude, the overall 850-micron background, are pretty close to what UV-selected populations would produce. There's no other explanation for why the background has the level it does or the shape it does. There are, of course, caveats here. There's a huge systematic uncertainty, and also, at the brightest end, it looked like the predicted number counts were off. Another argument is that virtually every known galaxy at redshifts greater than 1 is easier to detect in the UV than in the submillimeter. When you look at submillimeter selected galaxies after the fact, you discover that a number of them are quite bright in the UV. They would have been easier to find in the UV. But it turns out it's very rare when you have a UV selected galaxy to find one that's easier to detect in the submillimeter. So I think that provides some evidence that most of the star formation isn't hidden in the ultraviolet. Finally, there's the clustering of Lyman-Brake galaxies. Lyman-Brake galaxies cluster like the most massive galaxies in simulations. They cluster the way galaxies or dark matter halos with the same abundance should cluster. There doesn't seem to be any sign of incompleteness in that. If UV-selected surveys really were missing most of the star formation, you'd expect Lyman-Brake galaxies to cluster like less numerous objects if you were only getting, say, 1 in 10 of the star-forming galaxies at high redshift. But they don't. They cluster like just the brightest end of the mass function. There's slop in this argument, but there isn't room for a lot of Lyman-Brake galaxies to be hidden, I think. Finally, I didn't talk about this at all, but John Peacock has looked at small background fluctuations in the 850-micron image ever taken, and he's found that positive fluctuations tend to be spatially coincident with the locations of UV-selected galaxies. And he's used this to argue that UV-selected populations must contribute at least half of the 850-micron background. Okay, but then you can also argue it the other way. The brightest 850-micron sources greater than 6 millijansky, we really know a lot about the optical counterparts of these, and it looks like they're significantly fainter than I would have predicted. It looks like the majority of sources producing the bright end of the background are too faint to be in optical selected surveys. A dozen. It's not a lot. In order of a dozen. I don't know the exact number. Okay, but then caveats here. That's only a very small fraction of the backgrounds coming brighter than 6 millijanskys, less than 10%. So who knows what that means. Also, there's an unknown AGN contribution. We're really talking about what's responsible for the star formation. We should exclude the AGN contribution when we make these kind of arguments. Finally, I think an argument against this idea that UV-selected galaxies produce most of the background was the data I just showed you when we tried to predict the radio fluxes, the 15-micron fluxes, the 850-micron fluxes of these galaxies. We weren't wildly off, but if anything, we tended to be coming in a little bit low. There isn't all that much evidence that UV-selected high redshift galaxies are quite as bright at 850 microns as we would need for them to produce the entire 850-micron background. So I think the case is still open on this. It's probably the most significant, the most important question you can ask right now if you're interested in understanding the high redshift universe, because almost all the information we have at high redshift now is coming from UV-selected surveys just because the technology is more advanced. It's going to stay like this for the next decade at least. And so the most important question you can ask is, well, are these UV-selected surveys, which tell us most of what we know, are they telling us something of value? I don't know. I think the data is consistent with the idea that they are. I hope they are, but the case is still open. So let me hop ahead to my conclusions. With 8-meter class telescopes, it's finally become relatively easy to detect large number of high redshift galaxies. We can see star-forming galaxies over at least 90% of the age of the universe. We see them in big enough numbers to begin to make quantitative comparisons between star formation and structure formation at high redshift. I think so far the observations are matching the predictions of simplistic theories surprisingly well. A lot of the things we've observed were predicted ahead of time. Some of the things have been shown to match predictions after the fact. But either way, I think it's surprising how well it's doing. Finally, dust obscuration is probably the major source of uncertainty in the analysis. I feel okay with the belief that UV-selected surveys are giving a reasonably complete view of high redshift star formation, but it's easy to argue the other way as well, and I think only time will tell.
question from Elaine is what understood to be maybe about whether we were fighting or not the answer.
Let me pull out that plot. It's sort of medium range. But I'll okay, so if you believe the dust corrections, I haven't done this recently, but I think the most of the contributions coming sort of in this range near the knee of the luminosity function. So it's, you know, middle to right range. I mean, the problem is that you're just seeing a tiny fraction of the stars at one end of the IMF, and you're extrapolating out and trying to figure out. Yeah. I think that is a good argument, but it's uncertain because of the IMF, if you don't know. Sorry, you're asking. Yeah, I mean, because when they estimated the background, they had to take out the CMB. I would guess it's negligible because the angular clustering, even restricting to the shell at redshift 3, is almost equal to 0. And so if you average over z of 1 to 5, it'll be pretty close to 0. And then you have hundreds of galaxies in each, say, 9 arc minute field, and the fluctuations from an average of 100 will be relatively small.
Very small, sort of thin, like 2D, right? They're going their way, so, you know, Once you start nation, you mean to start bursting content, is that what you're describing?
Well, it depends what you mean when you say starburst. For example, things people call starburst in the local universe typically have sort of a long time scale for star formation, like giga-year sort of time scale. I don't think we know that. It's hard to know. Other properties in terms of morphology and things like that.
The problem is, if all of these accounts be simple, then probably in your scientific model and all the properties, you don't expect most of the stars to form in the first place, right? So you expect it's single, but.
Yeah, it's maybe 3% of Lyman Break galaxies are AGN. I mean, it's our spectra of low signal to noise, so we could be missing some, but 3% are obvious enough to, for us to pick it up. Well, I mean, a lot of data is in hand unanalyzed. Well, I mean, there's a lot of HST data of the galaxies in the Z of 1 and Z of 3 samples. Yeah. I mean, we tried to test that by seeing if they had the right dust emission that we'd predict, and it's not clear. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, first, we've analyzed a small sample of HST images.